Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
In the course of the century, you get vindications which are based to some extent on religious feeling, and I think it's important that that doesn't actually disappear and that that remains something which is always important to women's writing throughout the century. But you get very much stronger claims for women's public role.
As I continued working on it, I realized more and more that mental power had a very particular gendered coloration, and a gendered coloration that tended to exclude women. And that a whole set of other terms were also very central to defining woman's mind, such as mental capacities, mental cultivation.
Women in 18th century English literature and the Victorian debate on woman's mind, this week on Soundings. First, Harriet Guest of York University discusses her work in progress, a study entitled Experienced Women, Religion and Femininity in 18th Century Women's Writing. Following that, Suzanne Graver of Williams College discusses the Victorian debate on woman's mind. Harriet Guest, welcome to Soundings. Why are you interested in women's writing in the 18th century?
I became interested in women's writing in the 18th century because I collect 18th century books, and I was struck by what a very surprising number of books by women there are in the 18th century.
We're talking about a very high number, I take it.
Yes, yes.
What, have you put a 100, 1,000? How many?
I think the second figure rather than the first. Very large numbers of writings by women who I'd never heard of, as well as writings by a few more famous women, like Mary Wollstonecraft, for example. But it was the proliferation of writing by really quite obscure women. I mean, obscure in that their lives were not in any way dramatic or surprising, which first caught my attention. And because of my interest in feminism, I felt that it would be worth reading more of this. But the women I became most interested in are women like, for example, Mary Jones and Mary Masters, who are very obscure, actually. They lived, as far as I can see, really very inconspicuous sorts of lives. But like many other women in the century, they published the odd volume of poetry, a few letters. Their poetry tends to be very slight, very occasional. A lot of it is witty.
Why is it memorable, if this is the case, if it's slight and infrequently published?
The sense in which it is occasional and slight is itself actually what interests me. It's a poetry about sociability, about sociability was something which was very much valued in the course of the 18th century. It became more and more important.
Let's pause on that, Harriet. You mean what? How to be sociable? How to sort of fit into society? Like books of manners, that kind of thing? What was the function here?
Well, in the course of the century, as the middle classes became more powerful, as their notions of culture became increasingly dominant, everyday sorts of exchanges, the exchanges of a polite social commerce, really, became very much more a matter of public interest, really, than they ever had been before.
They became literary subjects after a fashion.
Yes, I mean, most noticeably in the novel. But this poetry is also engaged in this kind of social exchange. And it has a very particular inflection for these women, because in their letters they write about the position of women in 18th century society, sometimes with considerable anger, but very often with a kind of cool amusement. I feel very interested in the sorts of contradictions that these women face. The sense in which, for example, while it was in, while their sort of role in sociability and polishing manners, that sort of thing, was valuable and was encouraged, so that by the end of the century, reviewers could write that they were always pleased to see another publication by a woman, even if they thought it was more or less unreadable.
Talk about patronizing.
At the same time, publishing for women was a daring act. It was a kind of public exposure. Which,
why? Because this was a man's world, essentially, or what?
Well, because the middle classes valued domesticity so strongly, so that to publish was at once very desirable, this sort of public appearance of women, and it was a sort of articulation away from domesticity, which they valued. But on the other hand, it sort of violated that domesticity. And those sorts of contradictions seem to me to be very interesting and also very significant to the way in which, in the course of the century, you get an increasing number of what you might call feminist polemic writing.
Are these women writers, again, we're making a distinction between what they wrote about and the way they went about it. Did they acquire the male vocabulary, as it were, to talk about these things so that they could make their points? My sense of it is that they had to use some sort of a model and would therefore use what was available to them and then use it to their ends. Have I confused the issues there?
I think to some extent that's what's going on. I mean, clearly, in order to understand Wollstonecraft's writing, it's important to recognize the proximity of arguments about the French Revolution, about the rights of man. But I don't think it's just a matter of women assuming, as it were, a masculine voice. One of the things that goes on in the course of the 18th century, I think, is that the distinction between men and women becomes less clear, or the distinction between a masculine and a feminine mode of articulation becomes less clear.
What was the motive for that? All of this political turbulence that surrounds, that the century ends with? What brought that on?
I don't think I can explain the causes of the French Revolution.
No. No, I don't mean the revolution itself. I mean the causes for this politicizing. This activist note that women's writings, as you say, has acquired in the course of the century.
Well, I think if one were going to pick one factor which makes it more possible for women to speak in public, it would be the sense in which during the 18th century, commerce becomes really the source of wealth in England. It becomes recognized as what England is good at. England is a trading nation. So that with that rise in trade and commerce, people become alarmed at what they perceive as the luxury that may follow on commercial riches, the sense in which commerce, which is which involves hard work and industry and so forth, may actually produce indolence and ease and other things which are imagined to sap the nation's manhood. And so to blur the distinction between the sexes. And that sort of blurring seems to have two kinds of effects. I mean, often two kinds of effects that one can come across in the same person's writings, but nevertheless, distinct effects. And I think one is a kind of misogynistic emphasis on the difference between masculine and feminine modes of discourse, masculine and feminine spheres of activity.
And the second?
And the second is perhaps a sense of the importance of gender difference, and therefore the importance of understanding what is particular to women's position. The misogyny arises, I think, really from this anxiety about the blurring of gender difference. It's a way of stressing the difference between masculinity and femininity, to say men are virtuous, women are corrupt and wicked, obscene, in fact. An interesting example is the letters of Mary Jones, which I mentioned earlier.
Not a household name.
Not a household name.
A common name, but not a household name.
She writes in her letters about women in terms which suggest that women are frivolous, luxurious, so forth. That women basically spend too much time worrying about their clothes and going to parties, having fun. But, I mean, it's a particular kind of anxiety in this period about the role of women as consumers, the sense that they're spending too much time going shopping. Mary Wollstonecraft, for example, is very condemning about women who spend their time bargain hunting. She regards this bargain hunting as worse than prostitution.
Oh, my goodness.
She's really quite putting it quite strongly. And so that one could see a sort of misogynistic strain in that sort of writing by women, and a strain that seems to be associated with certain kinds of religious attitude. A condemnation of women's worldliness, of their preoccupation with material goods.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the contrast to this? What if these writers were expressing a misogyny, what were they after? What were they encouraging? We know what they were disparaging.
At the same time, really. I mean, very often, sort of in the next sentence, the same woman will be writing about the need for women to be better educated, something about which almost everybody agreed, as far as I can see, in the Enlightenment, conservative and radical thinkers alike. But they will be concerned with a kind of education that will tend to emphasize the sense in which women's capacities are being wasted, the sense in which their public contribution might be valuable. And it's not necessarily an emphasis on education that would be, as it were, sort of stern and quite unsympathetic and which would sort of prohibit women from going to parties or doing the shopping.
Harriet Guest, tell me about what appears to be a sort of a paradox, that many of the books, at least about women, that we know from the 18th century, things like, is it Clarissa, Pamela, books like that, these were books that were written by men. Have I got this right? Rather than women. Does this... obviously a contradiction of sorts here. What do you make of that?
I think this is to do with that increasing interest in understanding women's positions. That
sympathetically, you mean? Male writers looking at women or expressing women's sensibilities?
I think it's to some extent sympathetic, yes. Certainly, I think in Richardson's case, Richardson was the author of Clarissa and Pamela, the kind of interest he shows in women, which is really very, very, very dramatic, very striking, to emerge at that point in the mid-century, is directly to do with those worries about gender difference that I was talking about. And one could see in his writing exactly that combination of a kind of misogyny as well as, in many ways, a deeply sympathetic interest. You mentioned earlier the possibility that when women were writing in the 18th century, they might have been speaking the language of men, that they might have been adopting the political terms made available to them, and which were exactly the means of their oppression. And this seems a rather sort of contradictory or paradoxical position for women to have been taking up. And I suggested that wasn't entirely the case. I think if we imagine these texts speak to us immediately, directly, we do something similar. We assimilate them too readily to our own language, to our own concerns. It's important to respect that historical difference between us and them, between our language and theirs.
You're a feminist, Harriet Guest, but you sound like Sir Geoffrey Elton, who talks about respecting the past, taking it on its own terms. I got this right?
Yes, yes.
Harriet Guest teaches at York University in England. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During her recent fellowship year at the center, Harriet Guest worked on a project entitled Experienced Women, Religion and Femininity in 18th Century Women's Writing. Soundings continues now with a conversation featuring Suzanne Graver of Williams College. During her recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Suzanne Graver worked on a study of the Victorian debate on woman's mind. Here is Suzanne Graver.
The question of the players is in itself a very interesting question. You know, usually, often when we do history, we go for big names, and people always ask me, "So who were the figures in this?" And the figures in this are a lot of big names, a lot of names that would still be familiar to us today, others that would have been very familiar to the Victorians. They include, for example, people like F.D. Morris, who in 1848 founded the first teaching college for women. Mm-hmm. They include Herbert Spencer, who started off as a very strong advocate of women's rights and women's mental equality.
Now, is this the same man that figures in the Darwinian discussions?
So in his pre-Darwinian phase, though, right. He's still very interested in evolution, but before Darwin publishes things in the early 1850s, he's a strong advocate for the rights of women and says whatever differences exist, they're really quite minor and they should not be treated as a disability. 20 years later, he totally reverses his position and becomes an arch foe, in fact, of arguments for women's mental equality. And his arguments, as many of them are, rest far less ultimately on women's nature, which the Victorians were always trying to define, and much more on her role. And he wanted her role to be essentially reproductive. He wanted her in the family, and notions of equality define her as a political subject, and that was what he and many others were resisting. So partly it's the whole legacy of the Enlightenment, which remains very important in this debate all the way through. Questions of abstract rights grounded on the human capacity to reason. So that the roots of liberal feminism are at the center of this debate. And basically what we now call liberal feminism, rooted back there, was arguing was that mind has no sex. This is a radical claim to make, and it was based on the notion that we are first and foremost human beings, not sexual beings, and that distinctions of sex should not be determining political rights, equality, and so forth. So.
All right. Now, Suzanne Graver, you've used the word reason a number of times, and what jumps out of this discussion is that, there's reason here, okay, in the form of a rationale on the part of men saying, in effect, to the women, fine, you can have all these wonderful qualities as long as we set the terms of the debate and we figure out who's going to run what, both in the home and outside of the home. Was it as crude as that?
Well, it was as crude, in some ways it was as crude as that in some of the people who were arguing this. Mm-hmm. But in other ways, in a way it's easy for us to say, we were not subjected to this, we did not internalize this. There were many women arguing this same position. As the century progressed, and as women began to see, not so much through abstract ideology, but through very concrete social and economic situations, how unworkable this ideology was, then very strong critiques of it began to mount, which was saying the power of influence that you say women have is in fact powerlessness.
Right.
But that kind of analysis doesn't enter in with great frequency. It's there as a minor note until beginning about in the 1860s. And then some Victorians become very sharp about this. Mm-hmm. And people located themselves along many different points on this. And the arguments were often unbelievably intricate in the kinds of ins and outs. There were a lot of people that argued that women's power of influence was in fact a very substantial power. And that indirect power was preferable to direct power.
They were raising the kids, after all. That I take it, would enter into the shaping of the next generation.
That is right, Wayne, and that was central. This will make you a better mother.
Yeah.
But one of the real fractures in this ideology, and one of the things I think that kept the debate going in a way that I'm not sure an issue of abstract rights would ever have kept it going, is that by the 1850s, you had this domestic ideology that was certainly the prevailing one. It was not the only one, but certainly the prevailing one. By the 1850s, there was a census in 1851, which made concrete what a lot of people had already perceived. For a very large number of women in Victorian England, there was no possibility of marriage, like one-third of the women. Mm. There were demographic changes in the birth rate, for one thing, that I don't know how we account for. But that just got worse as the century went on. Men were emigrating. I mean, after all, this is the time of England expanding as a colonial power.
And the women were staying home?
Well,
remaining?
Middle-class women. And this is a debate about middle-class women.
Hmm.
And it's a debate about middle-class hegemony and what was threatening it and what might be solidifying it. And for a middle-class woman to go to the colonies, this was a total, you know, rejection of what her middle-class status was.
Let's look at a couple of specific issues, Suzanne Graver. A couple of words I'll put on the table. For example, education and prostitution. How did these Victorian debaters look at women's nature in terms of those two things? Give me a couple of minutes
right.
on each.
They are two central issues. I would want to add a couple of more because
sure.
you've keynoted two of the major ones. Education was at the center of this debate from the beginning throughout. I mean, it never changed.
Should we teach little girls?
Should we teach little girls? Mm. And when, in the early part of the period, in the 1830s and 40s, girls' education was horrendous. And I'm now talking about middle-class girls, mm-hmm. because I said that is what this debate is centering on. It was an education for accomplishments that would make them more marriageable. It was showy, ornamental. These were all terms that were used to critique it. By the 1850s, the first two women started sort of high schools that provided a good education for women. And that kind of got the battle going, as well as this teacher's college that was established in the late 1840s. Through the century, tremendous gains were made in this area.
Hmm.
So that, whereas in 1850 there were two good sort of high schools for girls, by 1900 there were 36. This had been organized, and they provided good education and relatively inexpensive education. One of the kind of really bad points in this debate, and one of the most dramatic, so we've looked at it, though it's not that representative, is what the medical establishment of England did at that point. Now, what they did was the argument that was the most threatening and that people really worried about was that they mounted an argument that the more women develop their mental capacities, the more they will harm their reproductive powers. And that maybe women had equal mental capacity ultimately, but they were physically weaker. So it was a resurrection of the old physical argument. Josephine Butler, who was a very important feminist figure in the whole issue of prostitution, by way of fighting for the repeal of a series of acts called the Contagious Diseases Acts that were passed in the 1860s, were providing state regulation of prostitution, but in ways that were horrible violations of women's rights. And Butler and others, though she spearheaded this, went to fight on behalf of women. And if you look at Butler's writings, because she began writing before the 1860s on women, she begins having a very conservative stance in terms of women's education. Women are really different, and so on and so forth.
In other words, don't educate them.
No, they wouldn't say don't educate at all. The argument, in fact, I should backtrack for a minute here. It's the intersections are very complex. The battle for women's higher education, in many ways, could be perceived as a conservative battle. It wasn't particularly radical. Many of the arguments made for getting women educated was that they would become companions to men. They wanted mental cultivation. It was also part of class status mm-hmm. that was involved here. What often happened, though, is that it was perceived as a good thing to educate women, but there were also very great concerns about what women would do with their knowledge. And what they wanted women to do with their knowledge was use it for self-discipline, self-restraint, and so on. But then how do you decide when people start learning where they're going to put the limits on
sure.
what they're knowing?
This is a question of ground rules. This is a question of trying to second-guess results and being overly cautious in that direction.
That's right. And Butler, I got sidetracked back to the education thing here because I wanted to qualify the incredible mix here of both of the implicit challenge to the structure of gender roles involved in a lot of this, and yet the resistance to challenging that much of the move to educate women, because actually they were doing it, was an effort to conciliate so things wouldn't explode.
Mm.
I think that recent work in many areas, including feminist theory, anthropology, in a lot of areas, has enabled us to understand, in the ways the most astute Victorians understood, some of them, though not, I think in some ways not as completely as we did, has enabled us to understand how so much of what we perceive to be sexual difference is socially produced. Mm-hmm. And I think that understanding that has helped us, in addition, to understand how difference, even when it may be invoked as power, how difference is often construed, is often itself a source of inequality, giving people unequal access to power. And I think we have a more critical perspective, at least people who were doing work in this area. I don't know how much in the culture at large this is prevalent. When I have discussions with people often who don't know anything about this, nature is regularly invoked.
Yeah, that's just not the way God intended it.
That's right.
That sort of stuff.
And I think that's a tendency, that's one of the hardest things to shed.
Mm-hmm. As my mother-in-law says, watch out for what you pray for. You may get it.
Yeah, that's a good, okay, it's a good closing line.
Suzanne Graver teaches at Williams College. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During her recent fellowship year at the center, Suzanne Graver worked on a study of the Victorian debate on woman's mind. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 509. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, two conversations. Edwin Curley of the University of Illinois at Chicago discusses his translation of the works of the Dutch philosopher Spinoza. Christopher Brooks of Durham University discusses law and politics in late medieval and Renaissance England. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. 125 years ago this week, four people charged with conspiracy in the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln were hanged at Washington, D.C. The first black member of the United States Supreme Court has a birthday this week. Thurgood Marshall was born in 1908. Other early July birthdays include Cecil Rhodes, the South African millionaire politician, George Sand, the French novelist, Thomas Clemson, the mining engineer and the man for whom Clemson University is named, America's 30th president, Calvin Coolidge, and the advice columnists Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren, both born in early July 1918. Finally, the first week in July marks a birthday for Sir Stamford Raffles, the English colonial official who founded Singapore. According to tradition, Sir Stamford landed there in 1819. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. Eighteenth-century women's literature and the Victorian debate on woman's mind, this week on Soundings. Harriet Guest of York University discusses her work in progress, a study entitled Experienced Women, Religion and Femininity in Eighteenth-Century Women's Writing. Following that, Suzanne Graver of Williams College discusses the Victorian debate on woman's mind. Literature, Society, and Feminism, this week on Soundings.